Welcome to WHQR's 2019 edition of Homemade Holiday Shorts. This annual program of seasonal stories and music is our gift to you, our listeners. My name is Rob Zappel, and it's my pleasure to be your host this evening. And I'd like to welcome our live audience here in WHQR's MC Ernie Gallery, and to extend greetings to our listeners in North and South Carolina. We also welcome friends near and far who are joining us through our live internet stream. Now, throughout the year, WHQR is proud to present diverse voices of the Southeast in features, interviews, and news stories. And tonight, we celebrate this season with two voices from our community reading beloved traditional stories. We also welcome our special musical guests, Da Howleys, who will start us off with Meli Kalikimaka. Take it away.
Mele Kalikimaka is the thing to say on a bright Hawaiian Christmas day. That's the island greeting that we send to you from the land where palm trees sway. Here we know that Christmas will be green and bright. The sun will shine by day and all the stars at night. Mele Kalikimaka is Hawaii's way to say Merry Christmas to you. Kalikimaka is the thing to say on a bright Hawaiian Christmas day. That's the island greeting that we send to you from the land where palm trees sway. Here we know that Christmas will be green and bright. Sun will shine by day and all the stars at night. Mele Kalikimaka is Hawaii's way to say Merry Christmas to you. To say Merry Christmas to you.
Yeah! Woo! Da Howleys! Thanks for the great song. Tonight, through the generosity of the author's family, we are fortunate to be able to bring you a special holiday story. The Greatest Gift by Philip Van Dorenstern is probably best known as the story on which the movie It's a Wonderful Life was based. Van Dorenstern was a noted Civil War historian and a biographer of Abraham Lincoln, Edgar Allan Poe, and John Wilkes Booth. He wrote books and short stories in a number of genres and was both an editor and publisher. He was also general manager of the Armed Services Editions, which helped get 122 million pocket-sized editions of books into the hands of U.S. military service members during World War II. Van Dorenstern said the idea for The Greatest Gift came to him in a dream, and when the short story initially failed to find a publisher, he privately printed 200 copies and sent them out as Christmas cards. One of them found its way into the hands of director Frank Capra, who helped turn the story into the cherished holiday movie. It was Frank Capra's son, Frank Capra Jr., who helped establish the film community right here in Wilmington, North Carolina. Now, this special story will be read by WHQR news director Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Yeah. Rachel is the host of a public affairs program, Coastline, a dedicated fan of the holiday season. She is also performing in A Christmas Carol, produced by Theater Exchange and running December 12th through the 22nd at Thalian Hall. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you, Rob. The little town straggling up the hill was bright with colored Christmas lights, but George Pratt did not see them. He was leaning over the railing of the iron bridge, staring down moodily at the black water. The current eddied and swirled like liquid glass, and occasionally a bit of ice, detached from the shore, would go gliding downstream to be swallowed up in the shadows under the bridge. The water looked paralyzingly cold. George wondered how long a man could stay alive in it. The glassy blackness had a strange hypnotic effect on him. He leaned still farther over the railing. "I wouldn't do that if I were you," a quiet voice beside him said. George turned resentfully to a little man he had never seen before. He was stout, well past middle age, and his round cheeks were pink in the winter air, as though they had just been shaved. "Wouldn't do what?" George asked sullenly. "What you were thinking of doing." "How do you know what I was thinking?" "Oh, we make it our business to know a lot of things," the stranger said easily. George wondered what the man's business was. He was a most unremarkable little person, the sort you would pass in a crowd and never notice. Unless you saw his bright blue eyes, that is. George wondered what the man's business was. You couldn't forget his eyes, for they were the kindest, sharpest eyes you ever saw. Nothing else about him was noteworthy. He wore a moth-eaten old fur cap and a shabby overcoat that was stretched tightly across his paunchy belly. He was carrying a small black satchel. It wasn't a doctor's bag. It was too large for that and not the right shape. It was a salesman's sample kit, George decided distastefully. The fellow was probably some sort of peddler, the kind who would go around poking his sharp little nose into other people's affairs. "Looks like snow, doesn't it?" the stranger said, glancing up appraisingly at the overcast sky. "It'll be nice to have a white Christmas. They're getting scarce these days, but so are a lot of things." He turned to face George squarely. "You all right now?" "Of course I'm all right. What made you think I wasn't? George fell silent before the stranger's quiet gaze. The little man shook his head. "You know, you shouldn't think of such things. And on Christmas Eve of all times, you've got to consider Mary. And your mother, too." George opened his mouth to ask how this stranger could know his wife's name, but the fellow anticipated him. "Don't ask me how I know such things. It's my business to know them. That's why I came along this way tonight. Lucky I did, too." He glanced down at the dark water and shuddered. "Well, if you know so much about me," George said, "give me just one good reason why I should be alive." The little man made a queer chuckling sound. "Come, come, it can't be that bad. You've got your job at the bank, and Mary, and the kids. You're healthy, young, and sick of everything," George cried. "I'm stuck here in this mud hole for life, doing the same dull work day after day. Other men are leading exciting lives, but I'm just a small town bank clerk that even the army didn't want. I never did anything really useful or interesting, and it looks as if I never will. I might just as well be dead. I might better be dead. Sometimes I wish I were. In fact, I wish I'd never been born." The little man stood looking at him in the growing darkness. "What was that you said?" he asked softly. "I said, I wish I'd never been born," George repeated firmly. "And I mean it, too." The stranger's pink cheeks glowed with excitement. "Why, that's wonderful. You've solved everything. I was afraid you were going to give me some trouble. But now you've got the solution yourself. You wish you'd never been born. All right. Okay. You haven't." "What do you mean?" George growled. "You haven't been born. Just that. You haven't been born. No one here knows you. You have no responsibilities, no job, no wife, no children. Why, you haven't even a mother. You couldn't have, of course. All your troubles are over. Your wish, I am happy to say, has been granted, officially." "Nuts," George snorted and turned away. The stranger ran after him and caught him by the arm. "You'd better take this with you," he said, holding out his satchel. It'll open a lot of doors that might otherwise be slammed in your face. What doors in whose face? George scoffed. I know everybody in this town. And besides, I'd like to see anybody slam a door in my face. Yes, I know, the little man said patiently, but take this anyway. It can't do any harm, and it may help. He opened the satchel and displayed a number of brushes. You'd be surprised how useful these brushes can be as introduction, especially the free ones, these, I mean. He hauled out a plain little hand brush. I'll show you how to use it. He thrust the satchel into George's reluctant hands and began. When the lady of the house comes to the door, you give her this and then talk fast. You say, good evening, madam. I'm from the World Cleaning Company, and I want to present you with this useful and handsome brush absolutely free. No obligation to purchase anything at all. After that, of course, it's a cinch. Now you try it. He forced the brush into George's hand. George promptly dropped the brush into the satchel and fumbled with the catch, finally closing it with an angry snap. Here, he said, and then stopped abruptly, for there was no one in sight. The little stranger must have slipped away into the bushes growing along the riverbank, George thought. He certainly wasn't going to play hide and seek with him. It was nearly dark and getting colder every minute. He shivered and turned up his collar. The street lights had been turned on, and Christmas candles in the windows glowed softly. The little town looked remarkably cheerful. After all, the place you grew up in was the one spot on earth where you could really feel at home. George felt a sudden burst of affection, even for crotchety old Hank Biddle, whose house he was passing. He remembered the quarrel he had had when his car had scraped a piece of bark out of Hank's big maple tree. George looked up at the vast spread of leafless branches towering over him in the darkness. The tree must have been growing there since Indian times. He felt a sudden twinge of guilt for the damage he had done. He had never stopped to inspect the wound, for he was ordinarily afraid to have Hank catch him even looking at the tree. Now, he stepped out boldly into the roadway to examine the huge trunk. Hank must have repaired the scar or painted it over, for there was no sign of it. George struck a match and bent down to look more closely. He straightened up with an odd sinking feeling in his stomach. There wasn't any scar. The bark was smooth and undamaged. He remembered what the little man at the bridge had said. It was all nonsense, of course, but the non-existent scar bothered him. When he reached the bank, he saw that something was wrong. The building was dark, and he knew he had turned the vault light on. He noticed, too, that someone had left the window shades up. He ran around to the front. There was a battered old sign fastened on the door. George could just make out the words, "For rent or sale. Apply James Silva, Real Estate." Perhaps it was some boy's trick, he thought wildly. Then he saw a pile of ancient leaves and tattered newspapers in the bank's ordinarily immaculate doorway. And the windows looked as though they hadn't been washed in years. A light was still burning across the street in Jim Silva's office. George dashed over and tore the door open. Jim looked up from his ledger book in surprise. "What can I do for you, young man?" he said in the polite voice he reserved for potential customers. "The bank," George said breathlessly. "What's the matter with it?" "The old bank building?" Jim Silva turned around and looked out of the window. "Nothing that I can see. Wouldn't like to rent or buy it, would you?" "You mean it's out of business?" "For a good 10 years. Went bust. Strange around these parts, ain't you?" George sagged against the wall. "I was here some time ago," he said weakly. "The bank was all right then. I even knew some of the people who worked there."
"Didn't know a fella named Marty Jenkins, did you?"
"Marty Jenkins? Why, he..."
George was about to say that Marty had never worked at the bank. Couldn't have. In fact, for when they had both left school, they had applied for a job there, and George had gotten it. But now, of course, things were different. He would have to be careful.
"No,
I didn't know him, he said slowly. Not really, that is. I'd heard of him. Then maybe you heard how he skipped out with $50,000. That's why the bank went broke. Pretty near ruined everybody around here. Silva was looking at him sharply. I was hoping for a minute maybe you'd know where he is. I lost plenty in that crash myself. We'd like to get our hands on Marty Jenkins. Didn't he have a brother? Seems to me he had a brother named Arthur. Art, oh sure, but he's all right. He don't know where his brother went. It's had a terrible effect on him too. Took to drink, he did. It's too bad. And hard on his wife. He married a nice girl. George felt the sinking feeling in his stomach again. Who did he marry? He demanded hoarsely. Both he and Art had courted Mary. Girl named Mary Thatcher, Silva said cheerfully. She lives up on the hill just this side of the church. Hey, where are you going? But George had bolted out of the office. He ran past the empty bank building and turned up the hill. For a moment, he thought of going straight to Mary. The house next to the church had been given them by her father as a wedding present. Naturally, Art Jenkins would have gotten it if he had married Mary. George wondered whether they had any children. Then he knew he couldn't face Mary, not yet anyway. He decided to visit his parents and find out more about her. There were candles burning in the windows of the little weather-beaten house on the side street, and a Christmas wreath was hanging on the glass panel of the front door. George raised the gate latch with a loud click. A dark shape on the porch jumped up and began to growl. Then it hurled itself down the steps, barking ferociously. Brownie, George shouted. Brownie, you old fool, stop that. Don't you know me? But the dog advanced menacingly and drove him back behind the gate. The porch light snapped on, and George's father stepped outside to call the dog off. The barking subsided to a low, angry growl. His father held the dog by the collar while George cautiously walked past. He could see that his father did not know him. "Is the lady of the house in?" he asked. His father waved toward the door. "Go on in," he said cordially. "I'll chain this dog up. She can be mean with strangers." His mother, who was waiting in the hallway, obviously did not recognize him. George opened his sample kit and grabbed the first brush that came to hand. "Good evening, ma'am," he said politely. "I'm from the World Cleaning Company. We're giving out a free sample brush. I thought you might like to have one. No obligation, no obligation at all." His voice faltered. His mother smiled at his awkwardness. "I suppose you'll want to sell me something. I'm not really sure I need any brushes." "No, I'm not selling anything," he assured her. "The regular salesman will be around in a few days. This is just, well, just a Christmas present from the company." "How nice," she said. "You people never gave away such good brushes before." "This is a special offer," he said. His father entered the hall and closed the door. "Won't you come in for a while and sit down?" his mother said. "You must be tired walking so much." "Thank you, ma'am. I don't mind if I do." He entered the little parlor and put his bag down on the floor. The room looked different somehow, although he could not figure out why. "I used to know this town pretty well," he said, to make conversation. "Knew some of the townspeople. I remember a girl named Mary Thatcher. She married Art Jenkins, I heard. You must know them." "Of course," his mother said. "We know Mary well." "Any children?" he asked casually. "Two, a boy and a girl." George sighed audibly. "My, you must be tired," his mother said. "Perhaps I can get you a cup of tea." "No, don't bother," he said. "I'll be having supper soon." He looked around the little parlor, trying to figure out why it looked different. Over the mantelpiece hung a framed photograph, which had been taken on his kid brother Harry's 16th birthday. He remembered how they had gone to Potter's studio to be photographed together. There was something queer about the picture. It took him a full minute to realize what it was. It showed only one figure, Harry's. "That your son?" he he asked. His mother's face clouded. She nodded, but said nothing. I think I met him too, George said hesitantly. His name's Harry, isn't it? His mother turned away, making a strange choking noise in her throat. Her husband put his arm clumsily around her shoulder. His voice, which was always mild and gentle, suddenly became harsh. You couldn't have met him, he said. He's been dead a long while. He was drowned the day that picture was taken. George's mind flew back to the long ago August afternoon when he and Harry had visited Potter's studio. On their way home, they had gone swimming. Harry had been seized with a cramp, he remembered. He had pulled him out of the water and had thought nothing of it. But suppose he hadn't been there. I'm sorry, he said miserably. I guess I'd better go. I hope you like the brush, and I wish you both a very Merry Christmas. There. He had put his foot in it again, wishing them a Merry Christmas when they were thinking about their dead son. Brownie tugged fiercely at her chain as George went down the porch steps and accompanied his departure with a hostile rolling growl. He wanted desperately now to see Mary. He wasn't sure he could stand not being recognized by her, but he had to see her. The lights were on in the church, and the choir was making last-minute preparations for Christmas vespers. The organ had been practicing Holy Night evening after evening until George had become thoroughly sick of it. But now, the music almost tore his heart out. He stumbled blindly up the path to his own house. The lawn was untidy, and the flower bushes he had kept carefully trimmed were neglected and badly sprouted. Art Jenkins could hardly be expected to care for such things. When he knocked at the door, there was a long silence, followed by the shout of a child. Then Mary came to the door. At the sight of her, George's voice almost failed him. "Merry Christmas, ma'am," he managed to say at last. His hands shook as he tried to open the satchel. "Come in," Mary said indifferently. "It's cold out." When George entered the living room, unhappy as he was, he could not help noticing with a secret grin that the too high-priced blue sofa they had often quarreled over was there. Evidently, Mary had gone through the same thing with Art Jenkins and had won the argument with him too. George got his satchel open. One of the brushes had a bright blue handle and vari-colored bristles. It was obviously a brush not intended to be given away. But George didn't care. He handed it to Mary. "This would be fine for your sofa," he said. "My, that's a pretty brush," she exclaimed. "You're giving it away free?" He nodded solemnly. "Special introductory offer. It's one way for the company to keep excess profits down." "Share them with its friends." She stroked the sofa gently with the brush, smoothing out the velvety nap. "It is a nice brush. Thank you." There was a sudden scream from the kitchen, and two small children rushed in. A little homely-faced girl flung herself into her mother's arms, sobbing loudly, as a boy of 7 came running after her, snapping a toy pistol at her head. "Mommy, she won't die," he yelled. "I shot her 100 times, but she won't die." "He looks just like Art Jenkins," George thought. "Acts like him, too." The boy suddenly turned his attention to him. "Who are you?" he demanded belligerently. He pointed his pistol at George and pulled the trigger. "You're dead," he cried. "You're dead. Why don't you fall down and die?" There was a heavy step on the porch. The boy looked frightened and backed away. George saw Mary glance apprehensively at the door. Art Jenkins came in. He stood for a moment in the doorway, clinging to the knob for support. His eyes were glazed, and his face was very red. "Who's this?" he demanded thickly. "He's a brush salesman," Mary tried to explain. "He gave me this brush." "Brush salesman," Art sneered. "Well, tell him to get out of here. We don't want no brushes." Art hiccuped violently and lurched across the room to the sofa, where he sat down suddenly. "And we don't want no brush salesman, neither."
"You'd better go," Mary whispered to George. "I'm sorry."
The boy edged toward George. "Go on. Go away. We don't want no brushes, and we don't want no old brush salesman, neither."
George looked despairingly at Mary. Her eyes were begging him to go.
Art had lifted his feet up on the sofa and was sprawling out on it, muttering unkind things about brush salesmen. George went to the door, followed by Art's son, who kept snapping the pistol at him and saying, "You're dead! Dead! Dead!"
Perhaps the boy was right, George thought, when he reached the porch. Maybe he was dead, or maybe this was all a bad dream from which he might eventually awake.
He wanted to find the little man on the bridge again and try to persuade him to cancel the whole deal. He hurried down the hill and broke into a run when he neared the river. George was relieved to see the little stranger standing on the bridge.
"I've had enough," he gasped. "Get me out of this. You got me into it."
The stranger raised his eyebrows. "I got you into it. I like that.
You were granted your wish. You got everything you asked for. You're the freest man on earth now. You have no ties. You can go anywhere, do anything. What more can you possibly want?"
"Change me back," George pleaded. "Change me back, please. Not just for my sake, but for others too. You don't know what a mess this town is in. You don't understand. I've got to get back. They need me here."
"I understand. Right enough," the stranger said slowly. "I just wanted to make sure you did. You had the greatest gift of all conferred upon you, the gift of life, of being a part of this world and taking a part in it. Yet you denied that gift." As the stranger spoke, the church bell high up on the hill sounded, calling the townspeople to Christmas vespers. Then the downtown church bell started ringing. "I've got to get back," George said desperately. "You can't cut me off like this. Why, it's murder."
"Suicide, rather, wouldn't you say?" The stranger murmured. "You brought it on yourself. However, since it's Christmas Eve, well, anyway, close your eyes and keep listening to the bells." His voice sank lower. "Keep listening to the bells."
George did as he was told. He felt a cold, wet snowdrop touch his cheek, and then another, and another. When he opened his eyes, the snow was falling fast, so fast it obscured everything around him. The little stranger could not be seen, but then neither could anything else. The snow was so thick that George had to grope for the bridge railing. As he started toward the village, he thought he heard someone saying, "Merry Christmas," but the bells were drowning out all rival sounds, so he could not be sure. When he reached Hank Biddle's house, he stopped and walked out into the roadway, peering down anxiously at the base of the big maple tree. The scar was there. Thank heaven. He touched the tree affectionately. He'd have to do something about the wound, get a tree surgeon or something. Anyway, he'd evidently been changed back. He was himself again. Maybe it was all a dream. Or perhaps he had been hypnotized by the smooth flowing black water. He had heard of such things. At the corner of Main and Bridge Streets, he almost collided with a hurrying figure. It was Jim Silva, the real estate agent. "Hello, George," Jim said cheerfully. "Late tonight, ain't you? I should think you'd want to be home early on Christmas Eve." George drew a long breath. "I just wanted to see if the bank is all right. I've got to make sure the vault light is on."
"Sure it's on. I saw it as I went past."
"Let's look, huh?" George said, pulling at Silva's sleeve. He wanted the assurance of a witness.
He dragged the surprised real estate dealer around to the front of the bank, where the light was gleaming through the falling snow. "I told you it was on," Silva said with some irritation.
"I had to make sure," George mumbled. "Thanks, and Merry Christmas!" Then he was off like a streak, running up the hill. He was in a hurry to get home, but not in such a hurry that he couldn't stop for a moment at his parents' house, where he wrestled with Brownie until the friendly old bulldog waggled all over with delight.
He grasped his startled brother's hand and wrung it frantically, wishing him an almost hysterical Merry Christmas. Then he dashed across the parlor to examine a certain photograph. He kissed his mother, joked with his father, and was out of the house a few seconds later, stumbling and slipping on the newly fallen snow as he ran on up the hill. The church was bright with light, and the choir and the organ were going full tilt. George flung the door to his home open and called out at the top of his voice, "Mary, where are you? Mary, kids?" His wife came toward him, dressed for going to church and making gestures to silence him. "I've just put the children to bed," she protested. "Now they'll..." But not another word could she get out of her mouth, for he smothered it with kisses and then dragged her up to the children's room, where he violated every tenet of parental behavior by madly embracing his son and his daughter and waking them up thoroughly. It was not until Mary got him downstairs that he began to be coherent. "I thought I'd lost you. Oh, Mary, I thought I'd lost you. What's the matter, darling?" she asked in bewilderment. He pulled her down on the sofa and kissed her again, and then, just as he was about to tell her about his queer dream, his fingers came in contact with something lying on the seat of the sofa. His voice froze. He did not even have to pick the thing up, for he knew what it was, and he knew that it would have a blue handle and vari-colored bristles.
Wow. Excellent. Thank you, Rachel. We're grateful to have the Howleys with us this evening. They've been a longtime fixture on the Wilmington music scene, bringing their unique musical style to many venues. Tonight we have with us Zach Hanner on ukulele. Zach is an actor, a director, and musician who has lived in Wilmington on and off since 1993. He is the executive director of the nonprofit acting outreach program, Superstar Academy, and also plays guitar in the Blarney Brogues Irish Band. John McIntyre on guitar was a founding member of De Howleys, who spent many years in the film industry in various camera departments. He's now a licensed therapist helping families in the Wilmington area. And on harmonica, we have Greg McLowan, who with his wife Sally owns Canvas Works, a custom boat canvas company that's been in business for 20 years. He also plays harp for the Polar Bear Blues Band. They join us again with Dominique, the Italian Christian donkey. Christmas donkey.
Non-denominational. <Wow.
laughs> Hey, chingity chink, pee-haw, pee-haw, it's Dominique the donkey. Chingity chink, pee-haw, pee-haw, the Italian Christmas donkey. Tra-la-la-la-la-la-la, la-la-la-la-la-la-la, la-la-la. La 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 la. Oh, Santa has a little friend, his name is Dominic. The cutest little donkey, oh, you never see him kick. When Santa visits his paisans with Dominic, he'll be. Because the reindeer cannot climb the hills of Italy. Hey, chingity ching, ee-haw, ee-haw, it's Dominic the donkey. Chingity ching, ee-haw, ee-haw, the Italian Christmas donkey. Tra la 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 la. La la la, la 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 la. Oh, jingle bells upon his ears and presents on the sled. Hey, look, the mayor's derby on the top of Dominic's head. A pair of shoes for Louis and a dress for Josephine. The label on the inside says they're made in Brooklyn. Hey, chingity chink, ee-haw, ee-haw, it's Dominic the donkey. Chingity chink, ee-haw, ee-haw, the Italian Christmas donkey. Tra la 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 la. La 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 la. Oh, children sing and clap their hands, and Dominic starts to dance. They talk Italian to him, and he even understands. Compare sing, compare su, and dance the tantarelle. When Giulio Masora comes to town and brings the chicharelle. Hey, chiggity ching, pee-haw, pee-haw, it's Dominic the donkey. Chiggity ching, pee-haw, pee-haw, the Italian Christmas donkey. Tra-la-la-la-la-la-la-la, la-la-la-la-la-la, la-la-la-la-la.
la 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 la.
Thank you, Da Howleys. Thank you. Woo. Well, our final story tonight is another perennial favorite of the holiday season. First published in 1905, The Gift of the Magi was written by North Carolina native William Sidney Porter, better known as O. Henry. There's a popular legend that the story was written in Pete's Tavern in the Gramercy Park neighborhood of Manhattan, near where the author lived and where a plaque now marks the spot. But wherever the story originated, it remains an enduring icon of self-sacrifice, devotion, and love. Tonight, it will be read by actress and teacher Eleanor Stafford. As an actress, Eleanor has performed on stages in Michigan, Kansas, California, and North Carolina. She currently works as a special education teacher in New Hanover County and is someone who recognizes the simplicity of storytelling as a portal to connection with other worlds, unexpected ideas, and universal truths. Here's Eleanor Stafford reading one of her favorite holiday stories, O. Henry's The Gift of the Magi. Take it away, Eleanor.
$1.87, that was all. And 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man and the butcher until one's cheeks burned with the silent imputation of parsimony that such close dealing implies. Three times Della counted it, $1.87, and the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but flop down on the shabby little couch and howl. So Della did it. Which instigates the moral reflection that life is made up of sobs, sniffles, and smiles, with sniffles predominating. While the mistress of the home is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second, take a look at the home. A furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beggar description, but it certainly had that word on the lookout for the mendicancy squad. In the vestibule below was a letterbox into which no letter would go, and an electric button from which no mortal finger could coax a ring. Also appertaining thereunto was a card bearing the name Mr. James Dillingham Young. The Dillingham had been flung to the breeze during a former period of prosperity when its possessor was being paid $30 a week. Now, when the income was shrunk to $20, the letters of Dillingham looked blurred as though they were thinking seriously of contracting to a modest and unassuming D. But whenever Mr. James Dillingham Young came home and reached his flat above, he was called Jim and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, already introduced to you as Della, which is all very good. Della finished her cry and attended to her cheeks with the powder rag. She stood by the window and looked out dully at a gray cat walking a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day, and she had only $1.87 with which to buy Jim a present. She had been saving every penny she could for months with this result. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses had been greater than she had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim, her Jim. Many a happy hour she had spent planning for something nice for him, something fine and rare and sterling, something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being owned by Jim. There was a pier glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you have seen a pier glass in an $8 flat. A very thin and very agile person may, by observing his reflection in a rapid sequence of longitudinal strips, obtain a fairly accurate conception of his looks. Della, being slender, had mastered the art. Suddenly, she whirled from the window and stood before the glass. Her eyes were shining brilliantly, but her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Rapidly, she pulled down her hair and let it fall to its full length. Now, there were two possessions of the James Dillingham Youngs in which they both took a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out the window some day to dry, just to depreciate Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed just to see him pluck at his beard in envy. So now, Della's beautiful hair fell about her, rippling and shining like a cascade of brown waters. It reached below her knee and made itself almost a garment for her. And then she did it up again, nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute and stood still while a tear or two splashed on the worn red carpet. On went her old brown jacket, on went her old brown hat. With a whirl of skirts and with the brilliant sparkle still in her eyes, she fluttered out the door and down the stairs to the street. Where she stopped, the sign read, Madame Sofronie, hair goods of all kinds. One flight up, Della ran and collected herself panting. Madame, large, too white, chilly, hardly looked the Sofronie. Will you buy my hair? Asked Della.
I buy hair, said Madame. Take your hat off. Let's have a sight of the looks of it.
Down rippled the brown cascade. $20, said Madame, lifting the mass with a practiced hand. Give it to me, quick, said Della. Oh, and the next 2 hours tripped by on rosy wings. Forget the hashed metaphor. She was ransacking the stores for Jim's present. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was no other like it in any of the stores, and she had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain. Simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone, and not by meretricious ornamentation, as all good things should do. It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be Jim's. It was like him. Quietness and value, the description applied to both. $21 they took from her for it, and she hurried home with the 87 cents. With that chain on his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on account of the old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way a little to prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons and lighted the gas and went to work, repairing the ravages made by generosity added to love, which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth task. Within 40 minutes, her head was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. She looked at her reflection in the mirror long, carefully, and critically. If Jim doesn't kill me, she said to herself before he takes a second look at me, he'll say I look like a Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? Oh, what could I do with $1.87? At 7 o'clock, the coffee was made and the frying pan was on the back of the stove, hot and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand and sat on the corner of the table near the door that he always entered. Then she heard his step on the stair, away down on the first flight, and she turned white for just a moment. She had a habit of saying little silent prayers about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered, "Please, God, make him think I am still pretty." The door opened, and Jim stepped in and closed it. He looked thin and very serious. Poor fellow. He was only 22, and to be burdened with a family. He needed a new overcoat, and he was without gloves. Jim stopped inside the door, as immovable as a setter at the scent of quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della, and there was an expression in them that she could not read, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disapproval, nor horror, nor any of the sentiments that she had been prepared for. He simply stared at her fixedly with that peculiar expression on his face. Della wriggled off the table and went for him. Jim, darling, she cried, don't look at me that way. I had my hair cut off and sold it because I couldn't have lived through Christmas without giving you a present. It'll grow out again. You won't mind, will you? I just had to do it. My hair grows awfully fast. Say Merry Christmas, Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a beautiful, nice gift I've got for you. You've cut your hair? Asked Jim laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact yet, even after the hardest mental labor. Cut it off and sold it, said Della. Don't you like me just as well without it? Anyhow, I'm me without my hair, ain't I? Jim looked about the room curiously. You say your hair is gone? He said, with an air almost of idiocy. You needn't look for it, said Della. It's sold, I tell you. Sold and gone, too. It's Christmas Eve, boy. Be good to me, for it went for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered, she went on, with a sudden serious sweetness, but nobody could count my love for you. Shall I put the chops on, Jim? Out of his trance, Jim seemed quickly to wake. He enfolded his Della. For 10 seconds, let us regard with discreet scrutiny some inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week or $1 million a year, what is the difference? A mathematician or a wit would give you the wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not among them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat pocket and threw it upon the table. Don't make any mistake, Del, he said, about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or a shave or a shampoo that could make me like my girl any less. But if you'll unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going a while at first. White fingers and Nimble tore at the string and paper, and then an ecstatic scream of joy. And then, alas, a quick feminine change to hysterical tears and wails, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers of the Lord of the Flat. For there lay the combs. The set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped for long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure tortoiseshell with jeweled rims, just the shade to wear in the beautiful vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession, and now they were hers. But the tresses that should have adorned the coveted adornments were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom, and at length she was able to look up with dim eyes and a smile and say, my hair grows so fast, Jim. And then Della leapt up like a little singed cat and cried, oh, Jim had not yet seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly upon her open palm. The dull, precious metal seemed to flash with a reflection of her bright and ardent spirit. Isn't it a dandy, Jim? I hunted all over town to find it. You'll have to look at the time 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks on it. Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled. Del, said he, let's put our Christmas presents away a while. They're too nice to use just at present. I sold the watch to get the money to buy your combs. And now suppose you put the chops on. The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the babe in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas presents. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of two foolish children in a flat who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that of all who give gifts, these two were the wisest. Of all who give and receive gifts, such as they are the wisest. Everywhere, they are the wisest. They are the Magi.
That was Eleanor Stafford reading O. Henry's The Gift of the Magi. And now we welcome back the Howleys playing their original song, Santa is a Hodad.
That's right. The water's cold, the crowds are thinning out, but there's always that one guy out there, 24/7, 364. That's why we all want to go surfing on Christmas Day. A got ice in the beard on his chinny chin chin. The wax on his board is wearing thin, and he always wipes out when he's hanging tin, 'cause Santa is a hodad. He's got some wood stapled to his sleigh. He says, "Waiter, dude," as he walks away. He's a bona fide kook, so the locals say, 'cause Santa is a hodad. He puts spray on tan on his hands and feet. He bought his board at an old swap meet. He goes out surfing in his boots and his socks, and then he ate off straight offs riding the rocks. Well, early next morning he's plowing through the lineup down at Malibu. So watch your back, 'cause he'll drop in on you. Oh, Santa is a hodad. See him down by the pier, it's 'cause he only works one day a year. He's a no-good poser, total hack. Got more dings on his board than presents in his sack. But now that Christmas time is near, we'll be real nice and full of cheer. But he'll still be a kook after the new year, 'cause Santa is a hodad. What up, Barney? Santa is a hodad. Adolf, straight off. Santa is a hodad.
Thank you. Thank you, DeHowleys.
Thank you, DeHowleys. Thank you. We have one more special gift from WHQR to you, our listeners. A Visit from St. Nicholas by Clement Clark Moore. 'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds with visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new fallen snow gave a luster of midday to objects below. When what to my wondering eyes did appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. With a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by names. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, to the top of the porch, now dash away all, dash away all, dash away all. As leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky, so up to the housetop the coursers they flew with a sleigh full of toys and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur, from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry, his cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His dull little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow. A stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke it encircled his head like a wreath. And he had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings and then turned with a jerk and laying a finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night." Now, you've been listening to Homemade Holiday Shorts, a live broadcast from WHQR Public Radio. We thank our readers, Eleanor Stafford and Rachel Lewis Hilburn, for sharing stories from the holiday season. Thanks also to our musical guests, the Howleys, with Zach Hanner, John McIntyre, and Greg McLowan. They'll be playing us out with Blue Christmas. We also extend special thanks to the family and representative of Philip Van Dornstern for his permission to read The Greatest Gift. Mary Bradley is the producer of tonight's production. Dorothy Rankin was the director. Our audio engineer, yes, thank you, Dorothy. Our audio engineer was George Scheibner with help from Lan Nichols. And thanks to all of those who helped create this evening, including Courtney Justice and Amanda Ake, along with the talented interns and staff at WHQR. Our wonderful holiday feast is provided by Milner's Cafe and Catering. My name again is Rob Zappel, and on behalf of the volunteers, staff, board of directors, our interim station manager, Doc Jardin, and your community public radio station, I thank all of you, near and far, for joining us tonight. We wish you the very best this winter season has to offer. A Merry Christmas, a joyful Kwanzaa, a Happy Hanukkah, and a terrific New Year. Homemade Holiday Shorts has been a production of WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina. Thank you and good night.